You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Why pay more for a separate CoQ10 supplement? Enjoy twice the benefits with SuperBeats Heart Chews Advanced. From the number one doctor, pharmacist, and cardiologist recommended beet brand for heart health support, the new SuperBeats Heart Chews Advanced by Human is now infused with CoQ10. That's essentially like getting CoQ10 for free. Our powerful blend of beetroot, grapeseed extract, and CoQ10 ingredients support nitric oxide production, healthy blood pressure, healthy CoQ10 levels, and heart-healthy energy with two tasty chews a day. Plus, SuperBeats Heart Chews Advance are plant-based, so you get heart-healthy energy without stimulants. For a limited time, get a free 30-day supply of SuperBeats Heart Chews on all bundles and 15% off your first order by going to radiobeats.com and using promo code DEAL. That's radiobeats.com, code DEAL.
And Eisenhower, he's having heart attacks. He has Crohn's disease and has part of his small intestine removed. In the middle of his presidency, he's this old guy. And we're in the Cold War and we have nuclear weapons. And so he executed this agreement with Nixon where if he said that he was unable, he would give power to Nixon. And then when he said he's better, he would take the power back. And if Nixon said he was unable, then Nixon could take power. But then if Eisenhower said, I'm okay now, he would take power back. That agreement between them was sort of the kernel around which the rest of the 25th Amendment coalesced.
Brian T. Cault is a professor of law and the Harold Norris Faculty Scholar at Michigan State University College of Law. He is the author of Unable, The Law, Politics, and Limits of Section 4 of the 25th Amendment. And he joins me today. Brian, thanks so much for coming on My History Can Beat Up Your Politics.
Well, thanks for having me.
The 25th is obviously in the news, impeachment dominates currently, but that hasn't stopped people from continuing to speculate about the 25th. And a lot of it comes from the election of Donald Trump. He didn't win a popular vote. And those that didn't vote for him, a lot of people say, well, there's this section in the Constitution where you can get rid of the president. Is that really a good purpose, though?
Well, I see where they're coming from. They want to use whatever they think might work. You look at the Constitution, there are a very limited number of things that can get a president out, but this isn't really the right tool for the job.
I remember seeing George W. Bush, elected president, wrote to friends, you know, this will be the last email I'll be sending because I don't send anything as president. And certainly Donald Trump has a different attitude in terms of public statements. And some people look at it and say, well, that's a crazy thing for a president to say. Really, your book is called Unable. How do you see unable? Does it have to be because of a medical condition?
Well, it doesn't have to be a medical condition. The people who think that when Trump tweets something crazy, that he's, you know, if he's lost his marbles, that it could apply to that. It could. It's not totally limited to just someone who's in a coma, has a stroke or something like that. But the title of the book is trying to convey a double meaning, and the subtitle, the Law, Politics, and Limits of the 25th, Section 4 of the 25th Amendment, is to convey that. It's really limited in what it can be used for. We're unable to use it for a situation like this. What Section 4 means when it says unable isn't clear from the document itself. They don't try to define it. What they do is they give us a process and decision makers, and they assign the decision to those people. And by looking at that structure, we can figure out what it works for, what it doesn't work for. And also looking at the legislative history, we can see what they were definitely trying to protect the president.
Yeah, and it's something that was not idly constructed. I mean, there are some big names, Birchbaugh and Robert Kennedy, involved in its construction.
Yes, and President Eisenhower and President Johnson were putting their weight behind it too, and I think it's important to recognize just politically that it wouldn't have been possible to get something through if it gave too much power to people to get rid of a president who was anything other than completely unable. So the structure really breaks it down into two parts. There are easy cases and hard cases. And the easy cases are where the president, for whatever reason, isn't going to be able to respond. He's in a coma. He's completely lost the ability to communicate. He's missing, something like that. And when that happens, it's designed to swiftly and certainly transfer power to the vice president. But in the other sorts of situations where the president can contest the action, and whatever else you can say about Donald Trump, I don't think there's any doubt that if they invoked Section 4, he would, maybe by Twitter, maybe on TV, but he would resist. He would contest the action. Section 4 sets up a process that protects the president in those situations and makes it really difficult for the president to lose, put several thumbs on his side of the scale. And I think the people who are calling for Section 4 to be used against President Trump are overlooking that part of the design.
It has to involve the vice president.
Yeah, just first of all, for starters, the people who declare the president unable to start the whole process out are not people who already wanted him out. They are the vice president and the cabinet. You need a vice president and a majority of the cabinet to invoke it. And then if the president contests it and the vice president and cabinet stick to their guns, then it goes to Congress. You need two-thirds in the House, two-thirds in the Senate, which is more in the House, on the House side, more than you need for impeachment and removal. So it was designed to be really hard to use. You're not going to get him out of office unless his people and significant numbers of Republicans in the House and Senate think that he's got to go.
Other parts of the 25th have been used. We've had a vice president appointed by the process of the 25th. We've had two of them. We've had presidents voluntarily give power to the vice president while they're under surgery. George H.W. Bush and Dick Cheney among the recipients of that. But Section 4 has never been used except by Hollywood screenwriters, it seems. And it seems like with a few exceptions, they're usually getting it wrong.
They are. I have a whole chapter in my book about that. And I wonder why. You know, some of them you can say, oh, well, they simplified it to be make the scene flow better. But there are a lot of times where they get things wrong. And the real version of Section 4 that they're ignoring or getting wrong would have been even more dramatic. And I don't know if they don't know or they don't care. But the bottom line is, since it's never been used in real life, people's understanding of it is inordinately shaped by what they see on TV. And so consequently, millions of people have a very skewed view of what Section 4 is about and how it's supposed to work.
You have like Homeland, where the vice president menacing the president. If you don't do what I want, I'm going to invoke this.
Yeah. And the thing, the Homeland, there was this time in 2018 where three shows, almost one after another, all used Section 4 storyline. And Homeland was, they were so close. They had the president give this great speech about how they were misusing Section 4 and how this isn't what it's supposed to be used for. And they had a chance to have the story make it clear that she was right, but they didn't. The only reason the president ended up winning that one was it turned out her opponents were the Russians had a conspiracy and that's what was going on. And so it was just a matter of the facts that made her win and not her legal argument, which in this case, because of the structure of Section 4, would have and should have won.
Of all movies, it seems like Dave gets it right.
Yeah, the movies in general, Air Force One and Dave, the movies in general have done a better job with it. With Dave, we see the chief of staff trying to avoid Section 4, pretending, getting an imposter to stand in for the president rather than let power go to the vice president. But which shows the limits of Section 4. There are still people who would want to protect the president, protect their own influence under his authority. But then at the very end, they get it right and they explain what happens. And they even say under the terms of the 25th Amendment, the vice president becomes acting president. And then pursuant to Section 1 becomes the president. And so they got it right. And Air Force One, same thing. Air Force One is a great example of what I was saying about how if they take the Section 4, how it's supposed to work, how it actually work, how it's supposed to play out, if they take that seriously, that makes for some fine drama, I think. And in Air Force One, they did a great job with that.
Your book, Unable, The Law, Politics, and Limits of Section 4 of the 25th Amendment, has a lot of detail on all of these various plots. So anyone, listen, if you're interested in really going, like, you know, show by show, movie by movie, you know, this is a book that you'll want to get. I do just want to bring up one more because my listener specifically asked me to ask you. It was about West Wing and how specifically how the West Wing handled it. Seems like they sort of ignored.
Yeah, very disappointing because I know a lot of people looked up to the West Wing as getting things right and getting the details right and having, you know, Josh would come out with some soliloquy explaining some technical detail or some history. But they got it wrong twice. I only mentioned one of them in the book, which is in season two when President Bartlet gets shot. They're trying to sort of echo the Reagan assassination. So he gets shot. They rush him to the hospital. And then there's this little crisis because they say he never signed the letter. They say if the president's going under general anesthesia, as President Bartlet was, he was in surgery, they said he's got to sign a letter. He's got to transfer power to the vice president. And this is referring to Section 3, where, as you mentioned, George H.W. Bush, Dick Cheney were acting president while President Reagan and George W. Bush, respectively, were getting colon surgery or colonoscopy. That's Section 3, and it's true. If the president is going to transfer power voluntarily, take it back without there being any other process, he's got to use Section 3. But there's also Section 4. And if the president is in surgery and he's under general anesthesia for hours and he hasn't used Section 3, that's precisely what Section 4 was for. But the whole episode, Leo McGarry, chief of staff, is acting like there is no Section 4. And then a few seasons later, the president's daughter is kidnapped, and he feels like he's not able to do his job. The mental strain is too much for him. So he transfers power. And the episode is called 25. The problem is there wasn't a vice president. And so he says he's invoking 25th Amendment to transfer power to the Speaker of the House. And you can't do that. 25th Amendment requires that there be a vice president. If there's no vice president, the president could declare himself unable. He could say, by analogy to the 25th Amendment, I'm doing this, and you know, it would probably work out, but it wouldn't be Section 3. You can't do it without a vice president. It's written very clearly into Section 3.
What happens at that point if that series of events they go, like, do we go to SCOTUS and have them decide, or does the president have to actually resign?
Well, I think under the political question doctrine, the Supreme Court probably wouldn't get involved in an uncontested case. So if the president really felt like President Bartlet did there, he really felt like he was unable and he wanted to transfer power to the Speaker of the House, you don't need the 25th Amendment for that. Article 2 of the Constitution says whenever the president is unable and the vice president is, you know, missing or unable, then it goes to the line of succession. And currently the line of succession law puts that to the Speaker of the House. And so the problem is Article 2 didn't provide any process, didn't provide any criteria, didn't designate any decision makers. So what the 25th Amendment did was to fill in those details. And I think having filled in those details, a president would be able to use that by analogy and say, okay, I'm declaring myself unable. No one's contesting this. It goes to the Speaker of the House. I think the more interesting and difficult question would be, what if we have a Section 4 situation? The president's unconscious, or he is clearly unable but is unwilling to use Section 3. And the Speaker of the House says, well, I'm acting president now because we don't have a president. Section 4 makes that really hard to do if the president contests it. What happens if the Speaker of the House comes in and he just says, well, Section 4 doesn't apply. I'm using Article 2. I'm just going to declare myself acting president. that would be pretty serious. I think it's fair to say that we have to have at least as much process in that situation as we would otherwise. So if the Speaker of the House, if there is no vice president, the Speaker of the House is next in line and a majority of the cabinet agree. And if the president disagrees, maybe send it to Congress and have them vote. Maybe that would work. The framers of Section 4 discussed whether they should provide for that situation where there is no vice president. And they decided that Section 4 was already long enough as it was. It's something I think it's 274 words.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided, no, that's not an issue. Section 2 of the 25th Amendment lets us fill vice presidential vacancies. So, you know, yeah, there's a risk here, but it's not worth clogging up the Constitution over. I'm not so sure I agree with that. I think they could have added 10 or 15 more words and done the job, but I'm certainly not going to question the political geniuses who actually got it through Congress. It's pretty rare to get an amendment through proactively as they did.
Yeah, it was a pretty fast approval through the Congress and the legislatures. I guess they were looking for no controversy, which I think they got in the case of that one.
Yeah, the main controversy was everyone agreed that something needed to be done, and the question was just what should it be. And the great political genius of Birch Bayh, if anyone wants to read his book on that, it was quite good, detailing the legislative maneuvering that went into getting it passed. What he did was he built a consensus ahead of time, and he got the American Bar Association and he got the Attorney General and he got everyone together to sort of agree on an approach, so that once it got into Congress, you know, everyone's got their own ideas, but he can say, well, all of these people have worked it out and we agreed this is the best way to do it, and so it went through. And his book on that is called One Heartbeat Away, and it was a good read.
So we discussed what might happen if there's no vice president, but since the vice president and a majority of the cabinet is the body that, at least right now, there is a provision in the section that allows Congress to change that, and you could discuss that as well. But since that's the reigning body now, let's talk about the cabinet. The cabinet should be a friendly bunch. It's people that the president appointed. Who constitutes the cabinet?
So the language that they use in Section 4, it doesn't name the cabinet as the cabinet. It refers to the principal officers of the executive departments. And that language is supposed to echo Article 2, but people look at that and they say, well, what does that mean? And what it means is very clear from the legislative history. And also, if you just look at the statutes in question, the executive departments to which they refer are designated in a statute. And currently that statute is 5 U.S.C. Section 101. And it names the 15 cabinet level positions, the 15 executive departments. So state, treasury, defense, et cetera. It does not include, this is the important part, it does not include any of the so-called cabinet-level positions. So presidents can add people or subtract people like the head of the EPA or the head of the Small Business Administration or the chief of staff, sometimes people say, is cabinet-level, or the UN ambassador or the trade representative. None of those people, even if they're quote-unquote cabinet-level, none of those people get to participate. It's just those 15 core positions. And they're also the 15 that are in the line of succession.
Got it. Okay. That's probably something that most people aren't aware of. And then there's the line that says that or other body as Congress might designate. I'm paraphrasing a bit there. Never eliminating the vice president, but Congress has an ability to actually set another possible body, like, for instance, I'm making some assumptions here, which you could correct, say an opposition Congress now or enough senators that are, say, concerned or something like that, they could say by a majority vote, vote of both houses, I guess, or just simply passing a bill the normal way. Now we designate this group of doctors at Walter Reed as the new body. You still have to have the vice president, if I'm not making a mistake, but then the vice president plus that body would then make the decision.
Yes. And there have been bills introduced over the years. There's one now Representative Jamie Raskin introduced to get some add some doctors into the mix. There's a couple of responses to that, though. One is just historically, the reason that that provision is in there was it was a compromise. There were some people who didn't want to designate the decision makers to sort of hardwire that into the amendment. And they wanted to just say Congress can, instead of putting all these details in Section 4 for this whole process, Congress can pass a law later that does this. And that didn't fly because people didn't think, I think correctly, that the states would like to write a blank check like that to Congress. But just to placate that constituency in within Congress, they said, well, if it turns out later that someone other than the cabinet would be good, we can take care of it then. The important thing to remember, though, is as legislation, that would be subject to veto by the president. So any legislation that's passed to make it easier to get the president out, presumably the president feels like there's a target on his back. He's going to veto that. And you need two-thirds in both houses to override the veto. So unless you've got that kind of support, which generally you won't have, I can imagine a scenario in which that happens, but I certainly don't think we're there now. I don't see that passing something like that on the fly.
No, that's a good point. It would have to almost happen in one president, one noble, forward-thinking president's administration, and then be used in another down the line. A lot of the section involves transmitting of letters. Like, for instance, the vice president can't just start barking orders. They have to transmit to the Speaker of the House and the Senate president that this condition of inability exists.
Well, the Senate president pro tem, actually the president of the Senate is the vice president, and in an earlier draft of the legislation it said transmit to the president of the Senate, till someone pointed out that the vice president would be transmitting a letter to himself. so they fixed that part. But yeah, I think it's to make it official, to make it above board. But it's important to note that power transfers when it's transmitted, not when it's received or acknowledged or anything like that. So once they send the email or the fax or send the courier down the street, the vice president can start barking orders. And that immediacy, that instantaneous effect was part of what they wanted to do here.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the Nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
I have to ask then, because then there's also a provision where the president can then transmit a letter saying that to the same people, saying that no such case of inability exists, and is a tweet sufficient for that?
I suppose if he tags the president pro tem and the speaker in his tweet, that might suffice. I'm not sure. The stakes are a little lower there because the president does not take power back immediately upon declaring that. It starts a 4-day waiting period where The vice president and cabinet can contest his resistance, and the vice president stays in charge in the meantime. But I suspect that whoever would be helping him out with the legal formalities here would probably say, yeah, you should probably sign a piece of paper and fax that over. But I suppose a tweet might work.
It's a modern day communication and has the immediacy of revealing the president's thoughts, as we know. That four-day waiting period intrigues me, as I know it would intrigue a lot of listeners. Let's talk about it. I mean, just in essence, it really does seem to me that the flaw in this system is that a VP could at least exercise power for 4 days, even for possibly malicious reasons. Not that they would.
Yeah, that was their main worry when they were writing this portion. My main worry, and this was a subject of a chapter in my earlier book, Constitutional Cliffhangers, A Legal Guide for Presidents and Their Enemies, is that a lot of people, when they read Section 4, misread this 4-day waiting period, and they think the president can take power back immediately. So I think the real risk is the way they drafted it a little bit vaguely. I don't think that it's hard to come up with the right reading here. Certainly, if you look at the legislative history, it's clear that the vice president's in charge. But if the president says he's in charge right away and starts tweeting about it, millions of people agree with him, yeah, that could get dicey.
Yeah, there's going to be pressure because the language says unless. I see where you're going with the language, and you're certainly more expert than me in this respect. But the language, it says unless within 4 days the vice president, contests this, the vice president, majority of the members of the executive departments contest it, which would, there's no other way to read that than you have to give a person 4 days if there's an unless.
I agree. Others don't, but I think it's extremely clear. As far as the vice president, some sort of coup, yes, they would have. I should step back and mention, people talk about, oh, this would be a coup, or they talk about impeachment, it would be a coup. And other people say, well, no, it wouldn't be because this is a constitutional process. And I get what they're saying, but it is fair to say that someone abusing a constitutional procedure could certainly be accused of an illicit seizure of power, even if they're using constitutional processes, if they're not really, and there's some movies and books about this, but they don't really believe that there's anything wrong with the president, they just want to take power and that's what they're doing, then I think it is fair to label it that way. So the framers of Section 4 were worried about that. They said, who should be in charge during that 4-day waiting period? Some people said, well, the president's the president, and he got elected. And if he says he's fine, then we should give him the benefit of the doubt and let him take power back immediately. And other people said, well, but if the vice president and cabinet have taken this extraordinary step, there's some reason to question that. And let's have a little time and let's cool things off a little bit. And ultimately what they decided was that it was more likely and more dangerous a prospect that we would have a president who was out of it, but couldn't realize that himself and could do a lot of damage that way, that was more likely and a greater risk than a usurping vice president and cabinet. And certainly they didn't think that that was, that the latter was impossible, that could happen, they said. But looking at history, looking at the reluctance vice presidents have had to assert themselves in these situations before Section 4, and looking at it after as well, I think they were probably right. There have been a lot more instances where the vice president and cabinet should have invoked Section 4 than there have been instances where there was a president who clinging to power and would do a lot of damage. It was that combination, and we haven't had any that have come to light, at least any instances in the 50 plus years since Section 5 came out of vice presidents sort of chomping at the bit to invoke Section 4. It's just too risky politically. Even if you wanted to do something like that, the odds of pulling it off are
I know there was a concern, I believe it was South Carolina, either Senate or legislature, before it was, they did end up passing the, ratifying the amendment, but they had some little concern, maybe in a law journal, South Carolina, about, you know, this might change how we pick VPs, and this is not really what people picking tickets are thinking about. I don't think, my view of the political situation, there's never been a substantial change in that aspect. I don't see presidents, you know, checking their six, to see if the person they're picking is going. You know, it seems like all the choices for both candidates and successful and unsuccessful vice presidential candidates have been made for all the typical reasons, balancing out the party. You know, Pence was a different type of Republican than Trump was, you know, governor, and that was the reason to pick him. And I don't see people picking, like, you know, Clinton purposely picks another Southern Democrat who's also very forceful, politically strong, at who could actually succeed him. Presidents so far and presidential candidates seem to be picking for the right reasons. I do wonder if Section 4 is ever actually executed at any time, if that would change that dynamic, and presidents might start saying, well, I'm going to pick this insignificant person that nobody likes. But I think so far it hasn't had.
Since we're talking about actual cases here, the one greatest instance of when Section 4 should have been invoked was when Reagan was shot, and he was in surgery. He was unconscious for several hours. He was totally out of it for a good while after that. And they should have invoked Section 4. They didn't. Most of the people involved admitted later that they probably should have. One of the reasons that they didn't, according to the books on this that I've read, sort of the inside accounts of it, is that George Bush was not one of them. He was he was picked to balance the ticket. He was from the moderate wing of the party. People didn't quite trust him, and so it was very difficult for him to think about sort of sticking his neck out, sort of asserting himself and say, "Well, I'm taking over." That would have looked disloyal. And if everyone else had come up to him, or they'd asked the doctors, and the doctor said, "Yes, by all means, transfer power. He can't do anything." If there had been a little more appreciation of what was going on at the time, and what was at stake, I think they probably could have gotten over that. But that vice presidential reluctance, because of that political balancing act, is why they didn't invoke Section 4. And they didn't want to look weak. That was the other thing. Reagan was the oldest president ever elected, and so the notion that he wasn't this superhuman paragon of vigor, anything that would convey weakness, they wanted to avoid that. They didn't want to look weak in front of the Russians. The Russians were moving troops around that day, and we weren't sure what was going on there. So there's a lot that goes into it. Even in a clear case like that, where they definitely should have invoked it, sometimes the politics can lead you to a different result.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree with that. We haven't had the arch villain vice president that is so often in the Hollywood movies, but certainly it is very plausible that a vice president very often will come from a different side of the party. I mean, Gore and Clinton was not the norm. You're usually going to have your McCains and your Palins. You're usually going to have your they're going to pick a governor and a congressman. You're usually going to pick people that aren't really so close and talking to each other all the time, or having the same group of friends. And yeah, I think you see that in the Reagan issue there. Certainly the West Wing sort of explores that, because after even their illegal use, if you will, or improper use of the 25th in the episode, that Bartlet is weakened after that, going through that season. They, you know, once it did, they're depicting perhaps accurately that after a president uses this, the rest of their presidency, even when they return and write that letter, yeah, there's this image is over their heads. Well, you couldn't do it when the time was needed. You were unable. Reagan, I think also, there's some talk that, Reagan, when the Reagan staff was going out and Howard Baker was coming in as chief of staff, you know, the Reagan people had warned the Baker people, maybe not the best source because they were a little bitter, that, hey, you might have to use the 25th here. This guy's, you know, a little out of it and stuff. And of course, Howard Baker set up some tests and observed him and found that, hey, that was not the case at all. At least to some versions that I saw.
Yeah, I have a little, brief discussion of that in chapter, 6 of the book. Reagan, it was a low moment in his second term. Iran-Contra was dragging him down and he was always sort of hands off, but he was just sort of hanging out in the residence all day watching movies and watching TV, and he wasn't reading anything they prepared for him. They were signing his name to stuff without him looking at it, like bad stuff here. And so they warned him about that. But then he gets the new chief of staff in, all these new people coming in, and he's right back in it. And that was the end of that.
Yeah, I think he was able, even in the last days, maybe not as quick, but certainly could beat the tail off anybody rhetorically or in TV speeches and the like. Of course, the great historical example of where, and there's many, but the one that a lot of people point to where we maybe could have used the 25th is Woodrow Wilson. He has a stroke. He suffers a second stroke in the White House, you know, and there, I mean, boy, did they not follow anything close to the 25th, it seems. I mean, Vice President Thomas Marshall comes to the door. He's sent away by the president's wife. There's some discussion among the Secretary of State and the president's doctor and the president's secretary about possibly doing something with Marshall, but then the secretary and doctor adamantly opposed to even having a cabinet meeting without Woodrow Wilson, which would defeat the whole purpose of having a cabinet decide back then. So what's your view of those events of 1919 and 1920?
It was really interesting because going back and looking at what was known publicly, my education on this had always been, oh, the whole thing was kept from the public. But at the beginning, Wilson's doctor was issuing press releases saying Wilson needs absolute rest, that he is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. I mean, they said it in so many words. So if we had had a Section 4 back then, presumably they would have used it, at least initially. The reason they didn't use it at the time, and this is one of the main things that inspired Section 4, one of the things about the original Constitution that they felt they had to change, was it wasn't clear if the president is unable and the vice president takes power as acting president, it wasn't clear from the Constitution that the president would take power back if and when he recovered. And so this is why they didn't transfer power when Garfield was shot and lingered for 3 months. And so if you don't know for sure that the president takes power back when he recovers, that makes the vice president stepping up even more of look even more like a power grab. And so that was part of the reason for Marshall's reluctance. Wilson also didn't particularly like Marshall. Mrs. Wilson definitely didn't like Marshall. They thought he was kind of a bumpkin and not serious enough. There were people in Congress, there were people in the cabinet who wanted Marshall to step up, but he just wasn't willing to do it. And then Wilson's doctor said the only thing that's driving him to try and recover is to get his power back. And so they made sort of a personal decision to protect his power, to make him recover better than maybe he would have otherwise, putting self in front of country in that case, because it definitely was detrimental to the country. Eventually, the Secretary of State said, well, I mean, we should be able to meet as a cabinet. Let's do that. Wilson finds out about that and fires the Secretary of State. He finds out about this when he's recovered enough that he can do things like that. Funny thing to me is the account of this written not too long after by the president's personal secretary, Joseph Tumulty, who says, Wilson said, when Lansing sought, Lansing's the Secretary of State, when Lansing sought to oust me, I was upon my back. I'm on my feet now, and I will not have disloyalty about me. So he fires Lansing. But at the moment Wilson said that, Tumulty said that the physically weak Wilson was sitting in an invalid chair when he said this. So he was not on his feet, in fact. This initial period where he was clearly unable, I think Section 4 would have been invoked, and he probably wouldn't have been able to do anything about it. But he also probably would have claimed that he was better fairly soon. So I'm not sure exactly how Section 4 sort of situation would have played out if Constitution had been amended before all this. I do know, just looking at the legislative history of Section 4, this was the number one thing that they wanted to address, a Woodrow Wilson or a James Garfield situation. That was supposed to be the easy case, and that was what they wanted Section 4 to avoid, and not a more marginal case of like a Calvin Coolidge who's depressed because his son died, and so he doesn't come out of his room. He, you know, sleeps 14 hours a day. That's a more marginal case, or even a Franklin Roosevelt who's got severe health issues. Maybe he's not at his best. That's not what they were trying to do. And it's very clear from the debates in the situations, they want to err on the side of letting the president keep his power.
Yeah, no, interesting questions. Again, I think it's also a who was vice president there was critical. If it was Bryan or Champ Clark, they would have stomped over some of the obstacles that president's doctor put up, some more forceful politician in that vice president's office. But with Marshall, I don't, you know, he says, I never wanted the place. Unless it was going to be handed to him, he wasn't going to force the issue. And all of that. And maybe history was better. I tend to, you know, I used to think somewhat that way. We really didn't need a Marshall at that time. An incapacitated Wilson might have been better, but, you know, I just had done a podcast talking about all of the civil rights violations and the Palmer raids and bad things that happened while Wilson was incapacitated and maybe could have tamped down, and maybe a more active president would have been better. It's just one of those questions people can debate about. Speaking of debates, you'd said in this issue, the fact that it hasn't all been resolved, that it hasn't actually been used as Section 4, that it's probably a good thing because there's so much time to debate it. Do you find that there's that given the time since the amendment to now, Hollywood aside, that there's enough constitutional law debate where there's some precedents established here?
You know, I think what the last 3 years have made clear, something that I think we all suspected before, but it is that politics trumps law for almost everyone. And this is why I try and write these things before the issues are at the forefront. I want to say, here's what the law is. Here's what's supposed to happen. Let's think these things through before we know which side we want to win. Because whatever it means the same thing, whether the president's a Democrat or a Republican. But that's not how people take it. Any argument you make that means that their side wins, that's what they'll put forward. And any side that taken to its logical conclusion says their side loses, they will dismiss, they will denigrate, they will say it's just you're only saying that because you support Trump. If I point out that there's a limit on the 25th Amendment that, oh, don't do this, it wouldn't work, then all of a sudden I'm backing the president's latest crazy tweet, which has nothing to do with. So I would have hoped that a time when it's being discussed would be a great opportunity. All this discussion is a chance to sort of educate people. And it hasn't really played out that way, I think, with the 25th Amendment, Section 4, mainly because it hasn't really gotten past the point of discussion. It is idle speculation at this point. If it were actually invoked, then I think people would learn a lot about it. And assuming that it all went the way it was supposed to, people would understand. But when it's not being used, and it's not supposed to, as I said, there are these limits that are why it's not being used. Because it's not being used, we don't have that. We just have conspiracy theories. And my favorite one, I spend way too much time on Twitter talking to people about this one, is people say, well, the thing is, you can't use the 25th Amendment if you don't have a cabinet. And that's why Trump has all of the people in his cabinet are acting secretaries. And it's all part of this plan. And I try and explain to people, it is unclear whether an acting secretary can vote or not. But first of all, there's only one out of the 15 that's acting, Wolf at Homeland Security. The other 14 are all Senate confirmed. So from the start, this notion that the whole cabinet or most of the cabinet is acting is just wrong. But even if the acting secretaries can't vote, then they're not in the denominator, right? You have four acting secretaries. Right now you have one, but let's say you have four. Okay, so you just need six out of the 11 who are left to vote yes, and you're fine. And you wouldn't be doing things with a slim majority anyway. You're going to need a unanimous, as a practical matter, a unanimous or a near unanimous cabinet. If the president is in a coma, then they're going to be unanimous. And if the president's not in a coma, they better be unanimous or they're not going to win when the vote goes to Congress because the president's going to contest it. So it's not like we even need to worry about a case where the vote goes one way if the actings count or the other way if the actings don't. Now, try taking everything I just said and putting it into 280 characters. It doesn't usually go too well for me.
Right. Totally understood. Hey, that's why we have podcasts. Besides anything that we discussed today, is there anything we missed, anything we should have hit on?
I guess I want to give more credit to President Eisenhower. Mm-hmm. If I had to, if people credit Birch Bayh for the Section 4, as they should, but I think that President Eisenhower deserves a lot of credit as well. This situation of an inadequate constitution had prevailed for 170 years at that point. And Eisenhower, he's having heart attacks. He has Crohn's disease and has part of his small intestine removed. In the middle of his presidency, he's this old guy. And we're in the Cold War and we have nuclear weapons ready to go. And he realizes this could be a disaster. If we don't have a steady hand at the helm, we could be in real trouble. And so he executed this agreement with Nixon where if he said that he was unable, would give power to Nixon. And then when he said he's better, he would take the power back. And if Nixon said he was unable, then Nixon could take power. But then if Eisenhower said, I'm okay now, he would take power back. That agreement between them was sort of the kernel around which the rest of the 25th Amendment coalesced. And Eisenhower had his attorney generals come up with some ideas and suggest some things, and that's what really got the ball rolling in Congress. So when Birch Bayh came in through this accident of history, Senator Kefauver dies and Birch Bayh becomes the chair of this subcommittee on constitutional amendments, this first term senator. He had something to pick up and run with, and he did a great job picking it up and running with it, but it was Eisenhower who put it there for him to pick up. And so I think he deserves a lot of credit.
I've been speaking with Brian C. Cault, professor of law, Michigan State University College of Law, and the author of Unable, The Law, Politics, and Limits of Section 4 of the 25th Amendment. There's so much more in the book than what we're able to talk about in one podcast. So highly recommend that you go to Amazon or wherever you get books and buy Unable. Brian, thanks so much for coming on My History Can Beat Up Your Politics.
Well, thanks. It was a lot of fun.
I want to thank you for listening. And there's much more to be had on the extra podcast for My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpoliticspremium.com.